Today is January 10th, 1968, and this is a meeting of the Criminal Law Revision Commission.
Word, Mr. Redden will not be here until tomorrow. Senator Mahoney is gone the entire month of January in, he'll be in Arizona. Dale Harlan has a flu, may be here tomorrow. And Mr. Spaulding informed Judge Burns that unless he settled a case, that he wouldn't be here today. But in any event, we do have a quorum, and we're very privileged today to have with us one of the outstanding authorities in criminal law and corrections in the entire United States. You will recall that Mr. Bill Wachowski told us about Saul Rubin, and of course we've known about him for a long time prior to that. But as you know, he is the general counsel to the National Council on Crime and Delinquency, and is recognized as a leading authority in the field of criminal law and corrections. Among many of his other accomplishments, he is the author of several books and texts, which we have here with us, including Psychiatry and Criminal Law, Guides for Juvenile Court Judges, Procedure and Evidence in Juvenile Court, Crime and Juvenile Delinquency, the Law of Criminal Correction, and I could go on and on. But I think that rather than trespass upon his time, at this time I'm privileged to ask Mr. Saul Rubin to come forward and inform this committee of you can sit here if you like. That's
well, I thank you very much for that kind introduction, and I thank you and the committee for letting me come here and speak of the things that I want to speak about. I'll make one other comment in the introduction, not to either belabor it or to deny anything, but there are some groups to which I can be presented as an authority and safely get by, but I think that I would like to say that there are some matters of controversy in this field, and they were highlighted by my chatting with Mr. Thornton just a moment ago, and so there are some areas of this field of law where I would not be an authority but an adversary. And I think, I had not really intended to talk in vain, but I think I'm going to. And I didn't really know what the structure of the meeting would be. But I guess, and I really wanted to talk in non-controversial terms, but I think that this commission and the other commissions around the country that are faced with the problem of modernizing their penal codes are really in areas of controversy. In a way, that's a pity, because if some group, whether it was the agency that I speak for, or the American Law Institute, or the American Bar Association, some highly respected group with the resources to make studies, could present an ideal program to states and groups like this, the whole thing would be a snap. You take your own code, you take a model, and you've got it, but it isn't that easy. There are perhaps three main, and this is altogether different from what I intended to say. And you have to tell me what your schedule is, and I guess you ought to interrupt me if this isn't what you want, because I will be responsive to what you want. So just keep track, and this is not a prepared thing. I'm here at your disposal. But as I say, because of this thing that was in the back of my mind, and which Mr. Thornton's observations lead me to, I think it's well to speak of it. The principal document that every state is turning to is the Model Penal Code. I might say the Model Penal Code is in a draft. It hasn't been adopted. I'm not sure why it hasn't been adopted by the American Law Institute, but it has not. I happen to be a member of the American Law Institute, and I work hard on the things that went into it, even though the point of view that I'm going to tell you about was adopted. That code is going to be used. It consists of three main portions. The biggest portion, about which we have something to say, but we have no real guidance to give any state. The first portion is the statement of definitions of substantive crimes, plus related elements such as attempts, conspiracy, responsibility, and so on. Now that is, in a sense, the biggest part of the greatest burden, the most difficult and time-consuming part of penal code revision for any state. That's going to be the biggest and most onerous job for this commission. Because you have to go through a large number, several hundred, definitions of crimes, examine them in relation to case law, examine them in relation to social reality, and bring them up to date, and that's not easy. The second part of the Model Penal Code that is involved, and I'm not even sure that this commission is going to be directly involved in it, is the structure for a State Department of Correction. Now, the correctional field was not particularly pleased with the structure suggested in the Model Penal Code because it was terribly complex and unwieldy. And although it might be suitable for the several largest industrial states in the nation, for most states it was too cumbersome. Our agency took several years to produce a model act in the field of Department of Correction structure and administration. We published that act in 1966, less than 2 years ago. One state adopted the act immediately, while even before it was published. Four states in 1967 adopted it, and I think that this structure for a Department of Correction is the one that's going to be commonly used by legislatures. But as I say, I'm not sure that this commission is concerned with that. The reason that we are concerned with it, and that in some way you must be concerned, is that there is no use in modernizing a criminal code on paper. It's easy to do, and the Model Penal Code of the American Law Institute does it. You can turn to the Model Penal Code and duplicate it. But the payoff is going to be what happens to your penal system in the state. Will that penal code improve whatever you think improvement would be? Would that penal code change systems within the state? Will it improve the administration of prisons? Will it improve prosecution? Will it make for better sentencing? So it's tremendously urgent that, and it's easily overlooked, that the penal code you write has to has to be seen in terms of the impact it will have on the penal system. Sentencing, probation, parole, and the administration of institutions. Now, I've touched on things that I and our agency can make very little contribution toward in terms of your work. The substantive definitions. I do have some things I might say on it, but that's, I'll skip that for the time being. And we do have a Department of Correction structure and administration that may be of interest to you. The basic thing that we want to bring to your attention, and again, I say we're very grateful for the opportunity of doing it. We are here to offer assistance if it is seen as useful and constructive. We have to be persuasive or it's nothing. We have no other standard except the rationality of what we have to say. Now, on sentencing, we would invest our greatest effort and want to do as much as we possibly could. If I have enough time, I'd like to take a few minutes to talk about our agency and how it operates and how we assume to suggest that what we publish has merit. As you know, Mr. Mashofsky, who has already testified, was a spokesman for the Oregon Council on Crime and Delinquency. Our agency is headquartered in New York City, where I work. I'm counsel and the legal department is there. Our publications are there and so on. But in about 20 states, citizens of those states have established councils which are a part of our organization. They are staffed by a full-time consultant who is paid by our agency, Mr. Compton here, who has perhaps engineered my part in today's meeting, is the consultant for the Oregon Council. Now, the Oregon Council has a program, just like all the other states, that it develops on the scene. It studies the penal system within the state, and it attempts to deal with legislation, administration, standard setting, and all kinds of assistance to juvenile courts, probation, and prison. But through the headquarters office, we promulgate basic policy standards which our agency adheres to. And the way in which we do that is something I'd like to speak of. It is not done by my sitting down and dreaming up what I think is a utopian piece of legislation. I'm not smart enough, and I don't know anybody in our agency who is smart enough to do that. We do it through leading figures in the field in which we are drafting the legislation. And so we have rather substantial councils, professional councils, other than the citizen councils, such as I've spoken. One of those councils is a council of judges made up of appellate judges, trial judges, representing both juvenile and family courts and criminal courts. It is a group that I think deserves respect and has high prestige. It has one representative from the Supreme Court of the United States, who is Mr. Justice Brennan. It has judges of the U.S. Courts of Appeals, state Supreme Court judges, and it has a number of trial judges. Judge Fort, Bill Fort, is a member of our Council of Judges and very actively engaged at this moment. See him later this week in the draft of model rules for a juvenile court, which I think will be very important. With people like this, we draft policy statements and model legislation. We produced, through the Council of Judges, a model sentencing act, which, if I'm not mistaken, has been distributed to every member of the commission. And the Model Sentencing Act is a very brief document. It explains in very few words why a particular statutory formulation has been recommended. the Model Sentencing Act is the way in which we would recommend to this commission and to any state commission the sentencing aspects of your proposed reform go. Now let me go back to the proposition that what you do has to accomplish more than look good on paper. Most correctional institutions or correctional systems in this country have certain ills in common. The principal institution for criminal defenders is a maximum security institution, fairly large in size, and principally custodial in everything it does. Despite the development of probation and parole over the years, in every state, according to the way we see it, according to the findings in the surveys we make, one of which not many years ago right here, both probation and parole are underused. Now, in part, that has to be solved by a wise use of probation and probation service by judges. But in part, it is a matter of response to administrative structure. And there isn't any doubt but that a statute can support probation or can hinder it. The same thing is true of parole. Actually, many things are happening in this field that states must conform to whether they like it or not. For example, the Supreme Court has handed down a decision a couple of months ago requiring that people who are on probation and who are alleged to have violated their probation are entitled to counsel at a hearing, and if they are indigent and want counsel, they are entitled to assigned counsel. It is necessary for this commission to provide the wherewithal of meeting that, because at the present time, as I read it very hastily some time ago, the Argonne statute is devoid of the necessary due process on the probation revocation, so that at a minimum those statutes have to be modernized in terms of Supreme Court decision of a constitutional nature. Another recent decision, the Specht case, I would say brings into serious question the operation of your sexual psychopath statute. But these are instances that are not the basic thing. The basic thing is what you see in your penal system. Now, when we looked at the problem of sentencing, the initial point of departure, I'm now speaking of this Model Sentencing Act, the work that the Council of Judges went through, and I was intimately involved in it, in that I was the principal staff person for the Council in doing that act. It took years before we could resolve some of the issues, and not all of them were satisfactorily resolved. But we said, if you look at the population of a state prison, very few, a relatively small percentage of the inmates of state prison are dangerous people in the sense that they will seriously assault someone. Most of them are property offenders. Some of them are of a very small order in terms of the money loss to individuals or community. A number of them are repeaters, but the kind of offense they repeat is again not a serious offense as we see it. So the first thing we struggled with was the definition of a dangerous offender. And we came up with something that is, in our judgment, relatively advanced as compared with existing statutes. It's not beyond criticism, but at least it says a statute should define dangerous offenders for what purpose. We make a a great distinction in the statute between dangerous and non-dangerous offenders. The dangerous offender is the person who really has to be locked up for the protection of the community. There are principally two categories of dangerous offender, actually three, but to get into detail, it isn't needed at the moment. The first category is the person who commits a serious assault on another person, or attempts to, or threatens to, serious bodily harm. Now, that's one part of the definition. We've said that a person who never commits anything but a property crime is not dangerous in that sense. He may still be committed to a penal institution under such a sentencing act, but he isn't dangerous to call for a long-term imprisonment. But not everybody who threatens or commits an assault is going to repeat that crime. So what you need is information about the personality of that defendant. And we have written into the statutory criteria the requirement that for a person to be in the category of a dangerous offender, he must be suffering from a severe personality disorder, indicating a propensity to commit further crime. Now, we've said that a person who is in this category can be sentenced to up to 30 years, subject to parole, just as you have. The second category of dangerous offender to us is not the disturbed person, and perhaps not the assaulted person, but the man in organized crime. This is something that perhaps in this state you're not familiar with, which is a lesson. Oh no. And that is the mafia, racketeering, people who have substantial organizations and are in a continuing criminal operation. Now for these people, we say it's not a question of personality, it's a question of their being apprehended for any felony. And it is found that they are in organized crime or racketeering. They are dangerous. Now, for the first individual, the individual who commits an assault or battery, in order for the court to know about it, the personality of that defendant, it is necessary to have the resource of a diagnostic worker. And so the Model Sentencing Act calls for a referral to a diagnostic worker at a state-operated center. Without being very well informed about the state of Oregon, I understand that a sum of money has been appropriated to establish a reception and diagnostic center in the Division of Corrections. But I inquired about it, and I understand that the diagnostic work it will do will be done for people after they are committed. Now, I think that's important in the correctional system, but it's far more important that judges have a diagnostic service available to them so that at the point of sentence, they know whether this person is of a personality that he will commit other crimes. He ought to know that whether you have a Model Sentencing Act or not. Having that in mind, we put into, again, this is all drafted by a committee of correctional leaders, people who draft the Standard Act for State Correctional Services. We put in a provision that the Department of Correction could offer the diagnostic service to judges at the point of sentencing. In other words, even for states that do not have a Model Sentencing Act, and may not have it for a long time and ever, they still have the responsibility of sentencing people. And for those people who are assaulted, it is important to know whether they are assaulted because of peculiar circumstances or because of their personality defects, requiring quite a different approach to treatment.
Mr. Rosen, pardon me for interrupting, but point of procedure, would you defer to complete your presentation or certain aspects of it prior to the questioning, or would you prefer that the members interrupt you as you go along?
I have a statement that I could complete because I would like to tell you about how the Model Sensing Act was used. However, feel free to interrupt at any point. And let's stop at this moment because I do have something in mind.
No, this question was asked of me, but if you wish, you can proceed up to a point and then indicate to us that you'll be ready for questions on that phase of it. Would that be satisfactory?
That would be, but please, I'm not trying to impose a pattern here of anything.
Fine.
And I'd love to interrupt at this point and respond to any questions or make a statement or whatever it may be before I proceed. I'd love that. Please, if I say anything that requires something additional.
All right, then, if that is satisfactory, unless you are interrupted, you indicate to us when you completed a certain phase of it, then we'll discuss it.
Yes, but please, interrupt me.
Fine.
I'm going hastily. There's a lot of material that I've worked through many times. Now, the Model Sensing Act was published in 1963. Pieces of it have been adopted in several states. As I say, the diagnostic facility for sensing purposes has been adopted in half a dozen states. And many states have this available today. And there are judges who may not have a state system who still can exercise an initiative and get a psychiatric workup if they want it. But in any event, half a dozen states have provided for this service. Another thing that's called for is a mandatory pre-sentence investigation by a probation service in all serious cases. Now, my understanding is that in this state, although it is not required by law, in practice, the probation service is not very far from achieving that. But I don't know. But in any event, the point is that before you can sentence with sufficient knowledge, you want to have a pre-sentence investigation in every felony case, plus the availability of a diagnostic workup in a small percentage of cases where a defendant is potentially dangerous. Now again, there are perhaps less than 20, maybe between perhaps 15 to 20 states that at present have a mandatory pre-sentence investigation in felony cases. Not by virtue of the Model Sentencing Act, but because this has been a standard to shoot at for a number of years. And as I say, a number of states have a diagnostic workup. In 1963 or 4, the state of Minnesota revised their penal code, and the Model Sentencing Act was available then, and they used some ingredients in it in defining dangerous offender. The state of Michigan adopted a youthful offender procedure, which is a part of the Model Sentencing Act, and about which I have not spoken, although it's an important thing. Now, the basic material that we urge in the Model Sentencing Act was presented to a Michigan committee with the responsibility that this commission has. And the book I brought with me is the code that that committee has produced, published by West Publishing Company. And do you have a copy of this? Did I give it? I'll leave this copy with you if I may.
Sure.
And we have a few more copies, but not a great number. And I've now, the rest of my presentation, I'd like to talk about this Michigan code, proposed code. It has excellent sponsorship and a good opportunity to pass on. This code, to a considerable extent, implements the Model Sentencing Act. And it does so because, in Michigan, we have a Michigan Council on Crime and Delinquency, which disseminated the Model Sentencing Act to the members. We worked very hard. We had testimony by our Michigan Council people as Mr. Mishofsky came. And I visited Michigan at one point. I was something of a commuter. It was a little easier to get to Detroit than it was. And you won't see too much of me, so don't worry about it. But we worked very hard on that Michigan government. I can tell you that they started with a sentencing structure that is quite different from the one they produced. And we said to them what we've said here. Your first draft will not change the penal system of the state of Michigan. which has the biggest penitentiary in the country, I guess in the world. I believe it has 5,000 inmates in one institution, Jackson Prison. And we said to them, your first draft is fine on paper, but it will not do anything for Jackson Prison. It will not do anything for probation and parole. Now let me just recite several ingredients. It will take me a few minutes and then I'll be through. Several ingredients that we saw as being required in a modern sentencing structure. And whether it appears in the Model Sentencing Act or anywhere else doesn't matter. And in this report, they don't cite the Model Sentencing Act, which is fine. But they started with high maximum terms for most offenders. Now, the experience is that long terms for most offenders is a futile thing to do and expensive. This is how you build up big populations in prisons. We've demonstrated that in a number of ways. One of them in a three-year project in Michigan, in Saginaw County, where our staff went in with the cooperation of the sentencing judge and simply elevated the use of probation, substantially reduced the rate of prison commitments, and the recidivism rate, the repeater rate, was reduced. So imprisonment for these people would not have been necessary and wasn't. Then another thing they had built into their first draft was minimum terms. Now, every state has a parole system. But if a state has substantial minimum terms, then it means that the parole system cannot operate until that minimum term, 2 years, 3 years, sometimes 5 years, has been served. But once those 2, 3, or 5 years have been served, this man has to be released anyway, so the parole system isn't operating. Now, I understand that in this state, there are no minimum terms built into the statute, but that the parole board has authority to establish minimum terms. And I haven't investigated that. I don't know what it is, and I'm not being critical. But I will say that in Michigan, the committee agreed that if it is the responsibility of the parole board to study a prisoner and release him at the most opportune time, they should not be restricted by minimum terms. We discussed the habitual offender statute. I might say that one of the things achieved in the Minnesota redraft, which again was a product of their use of the Model Sentencing Act, was that it was the first state in a generation that abolished the habitual offender statute, producing life terms of imprisonment. They abolished it. Nothing like that had happened since these statutes became popular in the 1920s. But the Michigan report similarly says it is repealed. Fortunately, we had the director of correction of the Michigan Department of Correction working with the committee. And he agreed with us. He said this is an outmoded structure. The habitual offender statute produces a number of life-term prisoners and other long-term prisoners who are not dangerous. So with his support, the committee adopted that. The report also would repeal their sexual psychopath statute. Now, a majority of the states have a sexual psychopath statute, and this state is one, and Michigan is one. But they are either very little used or used very chaotically, not consistently.
May I interrupt for a point?
By all means.
When you say sexual psychopath statute, you mean the civil commitment,
yes,
of sexual, dangerous sexual person?
Correct. Correct. In other words, in these states, you have a procedure which is often civil but sometimes criminal, too. It may be a second criminal procedure by which a man who has committed a sex crime, and it's not always a serious one.
Well, or a serious one. Excuse me, the reason I asked that question is because here we have both a civil commitment proceeding for a sexually dangerous person, plus we have a procedure for enhancing the penalty of those who have committed crimes of a sexual nature. And I wasn't able to distinguish which you were talking about. I didn't
both
interrupt. Both
are. No, do interrupt. Both. In other words, our view is that if you have a serious crime, such as an assaulted sexual act upon a child, an unconsenting girl, this is serious. But even sodomy between consenting adults is quite another story. And one of the, I'm not getting into that, but the point is that the Michigan draft says no criminal act for homosexual behavior between consenting adults. A number of states are doing this. But the point is that we say if it's a serious sex crime, then it gets a criminal penalty. But the civil proceeding, we would discard, and they've gone along with that, or any enhanced punishment, and they've gone along with that. And this is the spectrum that the Supreme Court has called into question. My thought is that if you read the spec case and read your own statute in the light of it, you probably have an invalid procedure under your sexual offense statute. But that's not true. Yes?
What you're saying then is that a dangerous offender, as you classified it earlier, is a dangerous offender regardless of the particular crime, and that he should be sentenced under the dangerous offender procedures and not be called upon to give up some extra time because he's in a particular class of dangerous offender.
That is exactly right, and it's right for another reason. Now, we've held conferences with psychiatrists on this very point. When I say we, I mean that the National Conference of State Trial Judges sponsored a conference at the American Bar Association meeting discussing this very issue. Several of the sentencing institutes sponsored by the federal circuits have dwelt on this issue, and by this time there's a certain amount of publication on it. And the reason I say that you're exactly right is this. Any psychiatrist will tell you that there are people who will commit acts of violence, particularly stabbing or other acts, who by sexually deviated people of very dangerous order, whose crime will not be sexual because they aren't equal to it. So these are people who are more dangerous than many sex offenders. So you are exactly right. We call for the repeal of the sexual psychopath statute because it doesn't put the finger on the dangerous person. So Michigan adopts that. Now, yes.
How do you counter the argument from the theory of sexually dangerous person statute? That the person who is removed from society simply because he is potentially dangerous because of mental illness doesn't really belong in the penitentiary, he belongs in some other sort of institution. It seems to me the only recourse that you offer is criminal prosecution and lengthy sentence.
That's a wonderful question, which I can answer only briefly. But I want to say that I've expanded on it in one of the books you were kind enough to mention, Psychiatry and Criminal Law. To answer it adequately, you would have to go into an examination of what happens to people who are committed under civil commitment, so-called, for treatment. There are a number of decisions of the state courts and the federal courts that say, if you don't give psychiatric treatment to these people, then your commitment is invalid. So that by virtue of this kind of litigation, the question of what happens to these people is examined by courts. And there are a number of decisions that have held. You're committing these people civilly, but you're not giving them treatment. You're just giving them a longer term. And some of them were even placed under civil commitment in prison. The better answer to it, however, is this. As we visualize it, a diagnostic center would be established. But there are places where mentally ill people who have committed crimes or haven't may be treated. If we ever arrived at the point where maximum security, custody, was used for the dangerous people, then you would not have a prison, a state prison of 1,000 people, or 2,000 or 5,000, but you could have an institution of 200 people. Now, no state in this country can provide psychiatric help or any useful form of therapy to 1,000 people in an institution, whether it's in a mental hospital or in a prison. But if you have an institution of 200, you can do it. So what we visualize is that if you, if the sentencing judge has the wherewithal to dwell upon the dangerous person, then you can reduce the size of your prison populations and really attempt to treat these people. Because you can, if you study the problem, you will find that the people who are committed as a sexual psychopath today get no better treatment than they get in prison. So what we visualize is that if they are dangerous, mentally disturbed, hopefully something will happen to the penal system. That's why I come back to a penal code that will do something for a penal system. And that's the real answer. It's kind of ideal. It won't happen overnight. But we visualize that these people will be treated because the state will be able to afford the resources, and they will be subject to release on parole.
Can you make provision in your corrections statutes for treatment while incarcerated, or treatment?
Yes, we do.
In the correctional institution.
Yeah. Pardon me for interrupting. Could you state your name so that we can have it in the record in your position?
Jacob Kanzer. I'm the district attorney's office in Portland, and I'm the bar criminal commander, criminal office.
Thank you very much.
Well, Mr. Rubin, if we accept your thesis then for incarceration and treatment for only those offenders whom we regard as dangerous, then we assume that there is no type of offender who is habitual, don't we?
No.
Well, we have a situation with the check writer, for example, who is without any question whatsoever the biggest recidivist that we have in our prisons across the country. These people are in need of treatment because there's obviously something wrong with them. They're not dangerous. We continually parole them, and they continually repeat. Now, if we don't, we regard them not as dangerous, so we don't incarcerate them and give them treatment. What do we do with them?
Very good. That's exactly where we are at in our presentation at this moment. The structure that we suggest in the model sentencing act is as follows with respect to commitments. Michigan doesn't have the death penalty, so the situation is congenial there. But we don't believe the death penalty. I don't know whether Arnold is executed.
No.
We don't have it. That's great. We said that murder in the first degree takes a lifetime of imprisonment, whereas we put murder in another category. The interesting thing to me is that at Michigan, it was even more lenient than we were suggesting. We were suggesting that for murder in the first degree, a life term must be the sentence. They said it may be 10 years too much.
In the draft.
In this draft. This draft. This is what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the Michigan proposal embraced in this draft. Now, then they said, they didn't define dangerous offender quite as we do, but what we said is that aside from murder in the first degree, a dangerous offender, however any state would define it, is committable for up to 30 years. To our astonishment, the Michigan draft says that the maximum is 20 years. Now, this is sound. Our view.
This is an indeterminate sentence. Isn't it?
This is an indeterminate sentence, which was another problem we had. Because what we said to Michigan was, your first draft provides for substantial minimum terms. Then, as I indicated a moment ago, your parole system is ousted from the possibility of operating to that degree. And they've changed that. So that they now have 20 years as the maximum sentence for the most serious offenders. With rare exceptions, those are offenders who commit crimes against the person. You see?
Crimes
of violence. So they beat us on that, which is, they say, astonishing. Then we have a provision for certain serious crimes that would be punishable by 10 years, even if the person doesn't fit into a dangerous offender category. And a state can name its own crimes. And they have that as their second grade of offense. But for the non-dangerous person, you may have a commitment of up to 5 years, which is a substantial term in most countries. In America, 5 years is thought of as a short term, but in most countries of Europe, in Scandinavian countries, 5 years is quite a long term imprisonment. So the structure that they provide is very close to the one that we recommended. Life term for murder, though they could go lower, 20 years for the dangerous person, 10 years for an intermediate group, and 5-year maximum for property offenders and other non-dangerous offenders, which is almost exactly what we were hoping.
That's larceny.
That's larceny. Except that I did notice in one instance, let me just say that they called felony A, B, and C, which is, all right, we don't call it that, but felony A, B, and C, and I noticed that one larceny crime calls for a 10-year sentence.
Do they divide their misdemeanors into category?
Yes.
New York State does?
Yes.
They do.
That's right. They have similar categories for their misdemeanors. I might say that our Model Sentencing Act does not go into misdemeanor structure. I wish we did, but we're dealing only with felonies, and I think there's nothing wrong with their system, except that they don't provide for parole under their misdemeanor structure.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman, I have a question that really underlies, I think, the basic thrust of Mr. Rubin's presentation, and that is this. We're really on the threshold of our entry in the criminal law revision. And we've been a long, long time in Oregon reaching this point, as Judge Francis sitting over there certainly knows, because 1959 he tried to start it, and where some of us are now. But as I take it from your presentation, Mr. Rubin, you feel that the first priority in the order of criminal law revision is that of procedural criminal law revision rather than substantive. Is this
no,
correct?
No. Do you call sentencing law procedural?
Yes. We have in the Oregon statute a series of chapters which I refer to as substantive criminal law. crimes against property, crimes against persons, a visual offender section, crimes relating to the use of firearms, it's another chapter, definitions. Then we have other sections relating to sentencing and procedure in the courts, and appointment of counsel. That it's been suggested that rather than go headlong into the whole thing at once, that we tackle one phase of it. And as I take it from your presentation, if you were going to place a priority on any one area, you would look first toward sentencing, parole, and probation. Is this right?
Not exactly.
Well, this is what I would like to have.
Yes, not exactly. And the reason for it is this. First of all, do you have a staff who's doing drafting?
We do now. We will. We're starting.
Yes.
Now.
Because in Michigan, they had two law school professors who gave great time to it. However, staff structure is. They went ahead on the whole thing at once. Now, I don't mean that they sat down and overnight they wrote this, because there were constant meetings with their committee. But when they had their first draft, it included both, or at least where we appeared on the scene, they had a first draft that was substantive and sentencing and correction. And they said, this is exactly the way it happened, they said, well, we've got this A, B, and C bit. Although they were defining it quite differently, in other words, A was 10 years to life, B was 3 to 20 years, or something like that. But that has changed. But the point is that their committee faced an issue which I think this committee faces right now, which we'll have to decide soon. Namely, what approach do you take to the people who commit crimes? Because until the Michigan draft said theft of this degree is grade A, B, or C, they had not really decided how serious that crime was. So they had to think simultaneously, at least in rough terms, of a sentencing structure and where any defined crime would go into it. Because when you're defining your substantive crimes,
and a verbal rephrase the second verb, if you use that. Well, where are you going to put that? How serious is it? In other words, as you're rewriting your statute, you have to, at least tentatively, at some point, say, this is grade A, felony, grade B, if you use the letters of A. You follow me?
Well, I follow you exactly, but of course, do you redefine larceny and adopt a comprehensive theft statute and go through the section relating to crimes on property and get your definitions first, or do you first make a basic decision in Oregon instead of providing 5 years as a maximum for OMFPD and 10 years for burglary not in a dwelling? Do you first make a basic decision that Oregon's going to adopt an intermediate sentencing act?
Yes, I think I do. I think that the first decision you have to make is not to get exactly specific on this. Because that, and they didn't, and I don't think you can. But the first decision you have to make is a little package, a constellation of things. And that is that, do we believe that it is useful to approach our definitions of crimes in terms of putting to one side those people who are dangerous in the sense of violence against the person, and however else you're going to define it, and to another side, people who commit crimes against the property. Then, you have to decide whether you are going to do what almost every state has done. Are you going to simplify your structure so that felonies, for example, fall into not more than 3 or 4 categories? Because if you decide that you need all of the diversity of sentencing that you have today, then that's another decision to be made. So that at least, in rough terms, I think you have to make that kind of decision right on.
Well, Mr. Rubin, isn't it true that most of the states that have acted in this field have, in fact, all of them, today have first acted upon the substantive law, as it were. But sentencing, as I understand what the other states have done, sentencing and parole, etc., and the indeterminate sentence are a little different type of procedural point than the grand jury system, the arraignment and procedure during the course of trial. And I think what they have done, if I understand it correctly, as they've gone through the substantive law in defining the crime, they have taken those portions of the procedural law which are so closely related with that and in effect have considered them to be a part of the substantive law. Isn't that correct?
Well, what they've done is this. So far as I know, it's true either of every state that in recent years has produced a new code or almost everyone. They have had in the same package. This is true in the Michigan code, and it's just as true in the New York code, which I think is poor. But in the same package, they had all of the different crimes, substantive crimes, redefined, and they have had their sentencing structure redefined. They have not gone into correctional administration. But every one of them is like Minnesota did that. In other words, when the Minnesota Code came out in 6304, they had a whole new restatement of their substantive crimes and a whole new statement of their sentencing. Many changes occur.
I know that in my thinking on this all along, I have associated sentencing with the substantive law, feeling that both of them should proceed together. We couldn't have one and retain the sentencing. And yet I distinguish that part of the procedural law from everything else connected with the trial, the arrest, and all the way through.
I think that's exactly the approach they have taken. For example, New York State just went into effect a penal code that includes all of the material in here, the substantive crimes and sentencing, but not a new code of criminal procedure dealing with grand jury, trial, arrest, and all the rest of it. They haven't even done that. So that it is possible to actually enact the substantive part, including sentencing, but without the procedure. But I don't think it would be suitable, and I don't know that anybody's done it, to enact the substantive crimes part without the sentencing.
For example, in Oregon, we have so many types of larceny
that if we were to reduce the categories to say two or three, we would still have before us all of the penalties, and we would of necessity have to do something about the sentencing. Otherwise, we'd be in a rather peculiar position. Would you agree with that?
End up with crimes without sentences.
Yeah.
I believe that. I believe what you've said.
Right.
Without
crimes.
Yeah.
I've got two or three questions, but I understand that you're saying we've got basically four ingredients for a modern sentencing program. You find one would be greater use of probation and shorter sentences. Two would be either shorter minimum terms or no restriction on minimum terms. Three would be the abolition of a habitual criminal act, and four would be the abolition of a sexual psychopath statute. The last two categories, you would treat them as either dangerous or non-dangerous offenders. And as I'm not a lawyer or a judge, and so all I know is what I read in the newspapers, and somebody said once, which I think is great, my opinion.
Or what you write.
Yeah, what I write. As I see it now in Oregon, most first offender felons were not considered by the judge to be a dangerous person or whose crime is not an aggravated crime against another person, or are probationed or put on suspended sentence. I would guess that somewhere over half of them. In some districts, in some circuit court districts in the state, almost everyone on his first felony conviction is either probationed or suspended, except for those people that a judge considers dangerous. You said something about the psychiatric workup in only being required in some cases. How is a judge supposed to know when this workup is required? Number one, we have, I guess, some judges almost always use a pre-sentence report for every case. Other judges seldom use it, seldom ask for it. How do you get the head shrinkers to agree? How do you get the judge to know when he wants the head shrinker? Every trial I go to or see, the prosecution has their head shrinker and the defense has their head shrinker, and they take the same criminal, apply the same set of facts to him, and come up with completely opposite answers as to whether he needs. Is maybe what I'm asking is, are you convinced that psychiatry is enough of a science so that we can, or is it still black magic art that some of us suspected?
Very good question. Again, because it is as good a question as it is, I had to write a book on it. And that was the name of the book. Now let me tell you briefly what the answer to it is. One of the other problems that every state tangles, and I don't think Michigan did it right, is the McNaughton rule for a change in McNaughton. It may surprise some people that our agency came out, although we didn't publish anything on this, we probably will soon, but we did work out a position on it, which is reflected in that book. We adhere to McNaughton. Now, people like Judge Bazelon would frown upon it. They would say, well, your McNaughton is, 1843, you're 100 years behind the times in psychiatry. The Durham rule is a total flop. I just read a recent an article just been published by Professor Aarons, I believe it was. I could give anybody the citation if you want. Brand new. Which examines the actual operation of the Durham rule in the District of Columbia. It is a flop, and that's all there is to it. And Bazelon himself has just come out with an opinion that says that. I can't give you the citation, I just read the case. But I can give his name in case if anybody wants it. Which matters, the Durham rule doesn't work. And you know why? Because the psychiatrists don't do what we tell them. And he's right. So why do we adhere to McNaughton? Especially if you visualize the Model Sentencing Act. We say that the McNaughton rule is a desirable rule because it is a narrow rule. And it says that unless somebody is so obviously off his nut, he should be adjudicated. so that the role of psychiatry is not so big on the sentence, on the trial, but it is relegated to the sentence. That's exactly the point. Now, so we say, and this is exactly what Judge Babylon is bewailing in this new case of his, and what's been amply demonstrated in the District of Columbia. The psychiatrists don't give them what they want. In addition to which, the issues involved are so confusing that the jury just decides on its own what it's going to do. So we have said, what you've just implied, namely that psychiatry cannot resolve this problem on the trial. And McNaughton is desirable because it is a narrow rule. Then what you've said is, on the sentence, where you are not involved in rules of evidence, at least not of the strict kind on the trial, and where a judge can handle the sentence, handle information on the sentence, quite informally, that's where psychiatric expertise may come into the picture usefully.
In other words, using McNaughton rather than Durham, you wind up with more people under a continuing treatment situation than you would have used Durham in the
trial stage. That's right. Yeah. Now, let me say one other thing, which is a reply to your first question. We've said this very briefly, but that's the essence of it. Your first question was, when does a judge decide that he wants a diagnostic record? Now, in this state, as you just pointed out, except for those judges who don't want to use probation, any judge who wants it can get a pre-sentence investigation. And as we spelled it out, at the point where the judge knows, either from the pre-sentence investigation, because in most instances there is no trial, or from the trial, or from anything else, or on motion of a prosecutor who may have information, he can then call for the diagnostic work. But it's not a separate proceeding. In other words, when a man's been convicted, a period of time must pass before the pre-sentence is made. Maybe a week, 2 weeks, whatever it may be. In those few instances in which information, and it may be in the pre-sentence, indicates, because probation officers are sufficiently well equipped to see this, as the judge does it himself, to indicate where the further study is needed. That's what we recommend.
Well, Mr. Chairman, then what you're suggesting is a continuation of the dual roles, and that is to say, a continuation of the pre-sentence function of the parole board or the corrections division in one instance, if the pre-sentence indicates that a diagnostic examination is feasible, then the judge may commit the defendant to the diagnostic facilities.
Well, the diagnostic before sentence.
All right. Yeah. Well, it seemed to me that the trend, and we got into this in the last session, and everybody in this room knows that we had some pretty rough times and, on this general subject, correction, control, probation. It seems to me, though, that the general trend is toward the establishment of a diagnostic facility, which, when a defendant is convicted of a crime, the judge sends the defendant, without respect to the pre-sentence report, to the diagnostic where a pre-sentence is compiled, and as part of that pre-sentence, the defendant is given a diagnostic evaluation, calls for psychological testing, calls for psychiatric testing, all these things. Then it's done on a kind of on a carte blanche basis. And at the end of the term or the period in the diagnostic facility, be it 30 or 60 days, the defendant's returned to the sentencing judge. Now, isn't that more or less the trend? And doing away with the duality of functions, as you suggest.
We are opposed to that. Psychiatric expertise for correctional services is very short in this country. There is no state that is able to provide a diagnostic workup for every convicted felon. That's point number one. You have to save your resources for the places where they count. And if you've got a bad check writer, you know him. You know he's going to repeat. You don't need a psychiatric worker. I'm exaggerating there. But the point is that you don't need a psychiatric worker for every defendant that you have. So you have to save them. Let me go on just a little bit. You have to save them for the people you put in a dangerous category, no matter how you define dangerousness. You have to be selective. The other part of it is that if you have a man who is potentially probation material, why should he be committed for 60 days? The whole trend today is not to keep people in jail in default of bail, as you well know. The purport of it being, there are many. One is that it prejudices the sentence. If a man comes from jail for sentence, he's going to get a worse sentence than the man who's out on bail. And so there's a prodigious movement in this country to substitute recognizance for low bail. Now, another thing that's extremely big at this moment, maybe 20 states enacted legislation to support it in 1967, and that's work release. The effort is to have people in the community, even if they're prisoners. So if you're going to have a man who is potentially probation material, and he's out on bail or on recognizance, why put him away for 60 days and make him a jailbird, which is what happens. So we would oppose that.
Well, the commitment to the diagnostic facility would not necessarily assume that he'd be given the full battle of psychiatric and psychological testing. The decision would be made upon his admittance there, whether or not this individual warranted it.
Well, and let me go into it a little bit more. We used psychiatrists in developing this material, and we've used them since, and we are going to bring together a panel of psychiatrists to discuss it once more at the May meeting for a Council of Judges. When we formulated this, Dr. Carl Menger was our expert. And he was enthusiastic about putting the psychiatric expertise on the sentence rather than on the trial. Now you may know Dr. Joseph Sack, who was with Menger for a long time. I think he's now heading an institution in New York. But about a year and a half ago, there was a joint sentencing institute conducted, sponsored by the 8th and 10th Judicial Circuits, and it was held in Denver, built entirely around problems of the Model Sentencing Act. And Dr. Sutton was there as one of the consultants, and Dr. Rome, who then was the president of the American Psychiatric Association, was present. And I think there were one or two other psychiatrists. Dr. Sutton challenged us on the necessity of an institutional commitment for diagnostic workers. He said, now we provided for a commitment for diagnosis. Dr. Sutton shook us up a bit. This is why we're still working on the problem. He said, you don't need it for many offenders. You can have a diagnostic workup on an outpatient basis, because after all, how many hours are actually spent in those tests? Why do you need 60 to 90 days? Now, but we did provide for a commitment for diagnostic purposes for the dangerous offender, and the reason for that is that they're going to be committed anyway, either as dangerous or non-dangerous. So the commitment for 60 days isn't spoiling anything there. But for the person who is potentially material for treatment in the community, the 60 or 90 day commitment is going to be destructive. The federal system has this, and I think it's wrong, and I've challenged them on it.
Jim Barton.
They may well change it.
You had a question. Would you state your name and...
Yes, I'm George Platt, Associate Professor of Law at the University of...
You were supposed to be sitting up here, Platt.
I came in late, thank you very much.
Well, you come right on up.
You made a remark that intrigues me very much. Mr. Chandler posed the question. You say in adopting the McNaughton rule, this shifts the emphasis from the trial, the expertise of the trial, to the sentencing. Do I understand you to say then that the psychiatrists agree on the McNaughton rule at a higher degree than they do, say, under the Durham rule or the Model Penal Code? Are they still not on both sides on the McNaughton rule?
Well, first of all, the psychiatrists did not agree with the formulation of responsibility on the Model Penal Code. And Dr. Manfred Guttmacher, for example, who was a member of their advisory panel, has pointed out that they did not agree. So that formulation didn't necessarily win the psychiatrists. Now, whether psychiatrists today would buy this or not, I don't know. And we ourselves are trying to learn, get the answer. But one thing is sure. The psychiatrists have not given, have not contributed to the trial what the Durham advocates expected of them. And all you have to do is to read two things that I've just cited, none of which, neither of which is in my book, which was published a couple of years ago. One is Richard Aaron's article, which is a 10-year study.
What is that in?
I'll have to send it to you. I'll have to send it to you. Let me make a note and I'll send it to you.
Fine.
Send it to you.
Mr. Chairman, may I address a question to
the I just want to finish the article. I want to make a note to send the reference to this article. Now, it's a very substantial study that examines the actual material in the District of Columbia, the nature of the reports they get, and how disillusioning it has all been. But the other is the decision, this recent decision, of, and I'll give you that decision if you want it.
Yes, the
site.
It's
in Law Week about 2 weeks ago, or pardon me, criminal.
Maybe you know, what was the name of the case?
I don't remember the name of it.
Well, I'll give you the
about 2 weeks ago,
that's Professor
criminal law, true criminal law.
Yes, and the other is this case of the Basilons, in which he plainly bewails the situation. The psychiatrists simply aren't giving it to him. One of the fascinating things in Professor Aaron's study is, this comes back to your point, that those defendants referred for diagnostic workup to the psychiatric facilities came back with meaningless reports, what we would call conclusions of law, except they were conclusions of psychiatry. Whereas when a defendant was referred to the general hospital, they got reports that were written in understandable English. Now, this is an aside, an extremely valuable point. So I'll give you these references, and whether the psychiatrists, as a result of all this, now are disillusioned about the Durham rule, I don't know. But this is the fact about how it operates.
One more comment. I'm sure Mr. Chan would be interested in it. Perhaps about the case in the advance sheet from the Oregon Supreme Court about 2 months ago, involving a case where a woman had slit the throat of her three small children. Four psychiatrists held that she was sane under McNaughton, and two held she was insane. I think that's the point he's making, that even under the McNaughton rule, which seemingly is much narrower, there's still a great diversity of psychiatric opinions.
No question about it. And anybody who reads a murder transcript with an insanity defense under McNaughton must throw up his hand. And that is why there are some people who would discard McNaughton too. But I'm not defending McNaughton, but all I'm saying is that there is no use in broadening that so that the combat of psychiatrists on the trial becomes utterly impossible. The other distinction is this, and this really is in favor of McNaughton. If you tell a juror, if you instruct a juror under McNaughton, you're really saying to him, you have to decide whether this man was out of his mind. Whereas when you try to instruct a jury in Durham, and even though the psychiatrists disagree, because the psychiatrists are not honest in a McNaughton controversy, and some of them say it in public and in writing. But a juror will understand McNaughton, but a juror will never understand Durham. And that's the issue.
But Judge Carl Francis, under McNaughton, you're eliminating the psychiatrist to one of two positions, but under Durham, you're giving him lots more.
That's right. You're confusing the psychiatrist and you're confusing the jury.
Judge Francis?
My inquiry of the witness is this. You have discussed Durham and McNaughton. Half a dozen years ago, Oregon repealed McNaughton and rejected Durham. It adopted the American Law Institute formulation. This was vetoed by the governor because the inadequacy of facilities which would be in existence if the American Law Institute formulation were accepted. Now, you haven't commented on the formulation. And I'd be grateful if you would do so, as to how you feel about the ALI formulation.
I'm opposed to it. I'm opposed to it because it's not too different from Durham or Curran's or any of them, because they all say that they all provide subtle tests on which on trial a psychiatrist can testify not only in two different ways, but in 10 different ways. That here was a man whose mentality was such that he could not conform his conduct to the requirements of the law. No matter how you slice it, that is different from saying he's out of his mind. He's a wild beast. And it's impossible to get the psychiatrist to testify lucidly and in agreement on it, and it's impossible to confront a jury with these things. Now, again, we didn't go into this in a big way in Michigan. They've adopted the ALI plan, half of it. And they've said that the other half of it, which I can tell you about very briefly, is probably unconstitutional. So that thing is a pain in the neck altogether. The second half of it was a ridiculous thing, which I criticized in my book, which says that whatever our definition is, if the defendant is a repetitive criminal, then it doesn't count. And it doesn't count.
Well, that took care of the sociopath, isn't it?
Yes. But if there's anything that's confusing in the minds of the psychiatrists, it's what is a psychopath and what is a sociopath and where do you put him? So the American Law Institute said, we've got a definition, but we won't count for a repeated defendant. Well, it doesn't make sense. And Michigan rejected that half of it. And I would reject the other half.
Mr. Rubin, I have a question that's a little departing something from what we're discussing. But in the other states that have adopted model codes, penal codes, or revised criminal code, and also those who are working on it now, what weight did the various commissions give to public reaction and public emotion? Now, for example, in the eastern part of our state, the livestock man feels that stealing a horse or stealing a cow is the most serious type of larceny that can exist. The railroad people feel that breaking into a train or a boxcar is one of the worst things that can happen. And in a local community where there's a vicious type of a sex offense that is committed, the people are up in arms with respect to that. And I know that in many cases where a person is convicted and released almost immediately, there's going to be a reaction on the part of the public. Perhaps we don't understand that we are not enforcing our criminal laws, that we're turning the criminals back loose upon society, and particularly in sex offenses, that we're doing something wrong. Now, in the hearings that the commissions had in their approach to this, did they take into consideration the public reaction, as I named?
The public reaction was not as significant on all of these crimes as it is here.
What do you mean by here?
In ARPA. In other words, this array of the nature of theft and bad check. There's no state that has a bad check problem in the correctional system as you do here. You have, I forget the figure, maybe one-third of your inmates.
That's right.
Oh, I think that's a scandal. There's no other state like that. So you have a problem, and you have to work it out. You have to work it out. You unquestionably have to change your law in that regard, at least to reduce the level of the offense, because you haven't got huge sums of money involved. They're small checks. But that's another thing. Now, the thing that excited the public at the New York hearings were several. One was capital punishment. And I don't know whether you know, but New York did, through the operation of that Penal Code Commission, one of the products was to abolish the death penalty with two exceptions, which was quite a historic change for New York State. Another was the sex offenses. This got almost more than anything else, the sex offenses, the homosexuality, got the public attention. So that the substantive crimes that we're talking about, even the violent crimes, kidnapping, rape, and theft, got very little attention except from the prosecutors, who were very influential. So that the nature of your public here is a little different, and I think you have to do an educational job with them. Look, we get laymen on our state councils, and I bet that the men and women who make up Our Oregon counsel are a good cross-section of eminently respectable opinion in this state. Now, why would they support these things? Maybe they don't overnight, and they develop their own program, but we have part of the problem, part of the job of using the state council. And we now have hundreds and hundreds of people like this. It's educational. And there, in some of our state consultants, I'm not suggesting how Lee comes and do things here, but some of our state consultants have taken our citizens who really formulate a policy for a state, spent them, taken them to prison. They've lived in the prison overnight. They have become acquainted with parole and probation. So you have to do an educational job on them. No question about it. But the experience in New York and the experience in Michigan is quite different.
Isn't part of the problem that we might have here in Oregon, because Senator Curry says that we got the public outcry as far as cattle rustling and various things, is that here in Oregon we've got so many different types of length of sentences. We've got life, we've got 25, we've got 20, 15, 12, 10, 8, 7, 5, 3, 2, and then this last session of the legislature even made one a one-year sentence to the penitentiary. And when you get involved in all these different degrees, then you can get into all kinds of problems of whether cattle rustling should be 5, 7, or 10. But if you limit the different down to your felony A, B, and C, you won't get into this problem so much as to public reactions to how serious a crime should be.
That's exactly right. And whatever disagreement there is on the structure of these codes and sentences between the drafters and ourselves, and whatever agreement there is, the fact is that they have all achieved a simplified classification of felonies and misdemeanors. So that part should not be too much of a problem. One problem arises that we were not able to prevail in Michigan, although we did in New York. I don't know whether we prevailed, but that's the way it's different. And I think this may be a useful thing to keep in mind here in this state. Our judgment is that within the maximum, whether it's in a simplified setup like this or in any existing structure, we want the judge to say what the maximum shall be. In other words, if theft of cattle is 20 years, we want the judge to be able to say, not only may we place him on probation, but if we want to commit him, we may commit him for 5 years instead of 20. Now, they wouldn't buy that in Michigan. I just can't understand why. Because if they're willing for a man to be placed on probation, or even to receive a fine, or to be have a suspended sentence, then you have to offer a sensible alternative that continues to grade it according to the judgment of the judge. But they said every offense gets the maximum. We disapprove of that for many reasons. But I do think that if you retain a judge-fixed maximum, this may be a convincing point for the people who are advocates of great variety. Because the variety should come not in terms of the offense, but in terms of the offense. A reasonable, saleable thing.
Judge Burns.
You spoke at some length of diagnostic workup as a occurring before the imposition of sentence, and perhaps occasionally before a probation decision. We have, as I think someone mentioned here, a statute now providing for that. When the funds are available, presumably a diagnostic center will be worked up after they are institutionalized. What statistics are you aware of that indicate what results come about in cases where the diagnostic workup is used? Now, I specifically refer to the federal system, where they are sentenced to the maximum. They go to Lompoc or some other similar diagnostic center for 90 days. They come back and the sentence is reopened, and the judge either probates or confines for such term as he sees fit. What statistics are you aware of as to the recidivism rate of those who were probated after a diagnostic workup, and the recidivism rate of those who are defunct after a diagnostic workup. Is my question clear? It's wordy like a judge's question probably is.
No. Without that statistics of that kind. Yes.
All right. That leads me to my next question. I figured that's what your answer would be.
Well, you'd have to ask the federal system.
I'm not aware of any figures myself. I thought perhaps you might be. My next question is, what magic is there in a psychiatrist? And basically, when you talk about a diagnostic workup, and this was said here two or three times this morning, well, you get a psychiatrist and a psychologist and all those people. Now, what you really mean is you have a psychiatrist look at it, and you have a psychologist look at it and test it. Then all those people may include perhaps a social worker type, but that's what you're talking about. What magic is there in a psychiatrist or a psychologist when he does this workup? What is your... The reason I ask that is I'm faced with this daily, and a little later today I'm going to tell you about a specific case that I'm faced with. And I will say to you frankly that a very sizable percentage of the so-called workup that I get, and there's various means that I have to get it, even though we don't have a statutory pre-sentence diagnostic center, most of it is just plain, absolute, unvarnished nonsense. He tells me, this man is a sociopath. That's great. I know that before I ever sent him there. That's all he tells me. What am I supposed to do with that man? It's eyewash. It's hogwash. That's what it is, most of the time.
Your question is, what magic is there? The answer is absolutely none. You've given the answer yourself, and you said it's hogwash. Now, I can assure you that when the judges, is it after all, the people who drafted this, were all judges, when the judges visualized this, it was, I said it took several years of work, they weren't buying psychiatry. And you may recall that earlier I said that Professor Aaron's study points out that the dyed-in-the-wool psychiatric workup is inferior to the general hospital workup. This is not an unimportant point. When Dr. Menninger spoke to us, he said, if you as a judge, because he was talking to judge, receive a report in jargon, give it back. Now, we are well aware of this. Very well aware of this. And that is why we are working on this problem. Let me tell you a little more about how we are working. I said that we would have a panel of psychiatrists at a session of our Council of Judges meeting beginning of May. We have an annual meeting of several days duration. This is where we work out these materials. We get some outside speakers. It's not open to the public, but we get speakers. We had Jim Bennett, director of the Federal Bureau, on this. And others. So we're getting them this time. Why are we getting them? Your problem is obviously the next problem after you publish this act. The psychiatric field is bankrupt on the issue of dangerousness as we've defined it. If we've accomplished nothing else in the Model Sentencing Act, it is to alert the psychiatric profession to the inadequacy of their understanding of this problem. I commend to you a recently published book by Dr. Seymour Halleck, published in 1967. Dr. Seymour Halleck, who's in the correctional system in the state of Wisconsin. His book is called Psychiatry and the Dilemmas of Crime. I think that's the title. Excellent book. I might say that he supports the Model Sentencing Act. I've never sold him on this, but he supports this. And he gets into a discussion of what psychiatry can and cannot do on this issue. Now, we agree that not only will the psychiatric workup be as jargonish, as you say, but in many places, a judge won't have it available to him. So we have undertaken to produce, and I can give you the draft. We have undertaken to produce a little pamphlet called Guides to the Judge in Sentencing the Dangerous Offender.